I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 12th of August. This hour, how should we update our employment policies to catch up with changes in the economy, workforce, and the way that people work today? We'll start with the new overtime rules announced in June by the president. It's expected to go into effect in January. We'll look at the real value of the minimum wage, discuss why Congress has not passed a significant new law nor updated any of the nation's labor or employment laws in many a year. And we'll take a look at the American dream for the next generation and how to achieve it. Our guest this hour has been immersed in these issues for decades, including as a member of the Clinton administration's Commission on the Future of Worker Management Relations in the early 90s. He is Professor Thomas Calkin, Professor of Management of Work and Employment Research and Engineering Systems, and the co-director of the MIT Sloan Institute for Work and Employment Research at the MIT Sloan School of Management. His most recent book is Restoring the American Dream, A Working Family's Agenda for America, and he has Wisconsin ties, receiving his master's and a PhD in industrial relations from UW-Madison. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of this hour. When we get on these subjects, we get a lot of phone calls, and we'll take as many as we can. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Professor Calkin, thank you very much for being with us. We have a lot to talk about, and we appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me, Kathleen.
Yeah.
It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you. Let's start with these new overtime rules announced in June by President Obama. It's estimated it will affect over 5 million workers. What are the new rules?
Well, the rules increase the threshold for which people can be exempt from overtime. The current threshold is about $23,600 a year, and that hasn't been changed in a long time. Meanwhile, salaries have gone up, and a lot of people are exempt from overtime that really are doing hourly work. The president proposes to increase it quite a bit to $50,440 a year. So you'd have to earn at least that much to be exempt from overtime. And it is also indexed to inflation going forward. So it's a pretty substantial change.
Mm-hmm. And being done by executive action because Congress can't get its act together to deal with these issues?
And that's right. The Congress is gridlocked not only on overtime rules and other aspects of wage and hour law, but on basically all of our employment and labor legislation today. The Republicans don't want to change anything, or if anything, they want to roll back government regulations, and many in the administration and many people who study these issues recognize that we need some pretty fundamental updating of our laws and our rules, but we just can't get it through Congress.
Mm-hmm. You've written about the line separating salaried managers who are exempt from overtime rules and hourly workers who are covered. That by the 90s, it had become very blurred. Can you talk about how that figured into this decision to change the threshold?
Well, over time, the way in which work is organized has changed dramatically. These rules were first put in place in the 1930s when our basic wage and hour law was passed, and you had an industrial economy where supervisors and managers did the thinking, the design of work, the supervision, and hourly workers were separated, basically had rights to collective bargaining and other rules, but were not considered part of management, and they were expected to work on an hourly basis. So that's where it came from. But over time, as we move more to the service economy, as we move more toward teamwork, even in manufacturing and in other industries, as employees become much more educated and technology allows them to have more information, the line between manager and hourly employee gets very blurred. And their tasks change. They start working together, side by side in teams. They fill in for each other. They work to share information, to plan their work schedules, and how work gets done. So the distinction between, quote, exempt managerial employees and non-exempt hourly employees is really much, much more blurred. We saw this on the Commission on Worker Management Relations that you mentioned at the outset in the 1990s. And we, on the commission, favored moving toward a salary threshold like is being proposed here. But even then, gridlock kept us from getting anything done.
You talk about how long this took, that it was a slow process, taking almost a year for the Labor Department to develop these new overtime rules. And now we still have to go through, what, a period of public comment, and you suggest that there could be legal challenges?
Oh, yes. There's a 60-day formal period of public comment. Many business groups are already asking for an extension for more time. There's likely to be then time for the Labor Department to consider all the public input that it gets. So we will be very fortunate if new rules appear in place by the end of the calendar year. It's more likely to take longer. And then inevitably there will be some groups that will go to court to try to block it, and then it's up to the federal judges to decide whether there's any merit in efforts to block it, or whether they should just go forward and let the Labor Department implement whatever revisions it finally decides on.
Why is it that Congress really hasn't, as you say, passed a significant new law nor updated any of the nation's New Deal vintage labor or employment laws in decades? And yet we're seeing this huge income gap. Inequality is rampant. There's a crying need for some kind of change here for people to feel like they, you know, can get ahead a little bit, and not many people are. Why aren't we dealing with this in so many years?
Oh, there's an absolute need for a fundamental reform and updating of our labor and employment laws. But unfortunately, the gridlock in Congress reflects a deep ideological impasse between business and labor in our society. The business community doesn't want to do anything that would increase the power of workers or of unions that represent workers. It doesn't want to do anything that would increase their costs, even though in some cases the best employers in the country are really being treated at a disadvantage by those employers that are skirting the law or are sort of just meeting the minimum conditions. That creates a competitive problem for the best employers. But we can't break this ideological consensus within the business community that they should oppose essentially any progress on labor and employment legislation. Then you add to that the more extreme positions in Congress at the moment, with very small portions of the right-wing groups controlling the key committees and making sure that no new legislation can see the light of day.
You did a very interesting course recently, The American Dream for the Next Generation and How to Achieve It, with students from 151 countries signing up, 7,900 students. It made me think we should get a panel of some of those students to talk about their dreams. You also have written about the social contract that we had in place for about 30 years. We don't have that in place now. From that course, what did you from the students you had in your class, what did they say about what a new social contract should look like now, and what do you think about that?
Well, the first point to note is that the students are really motivated to address the big problems in our society, and they're anxious to have the tools that they need in order to both make a decent living but also to make a real contribution, whether that's environmental concerns or income inequality or addressing our health care problems or other issues. So we have a workforce of the future that's motivated to get on with the issues. The second thing is they just see the current situation as stacked against them. They're starting off with huge amounts of student debt. As we all know, many of them are underemployed because they can't get jobs in their areas where they've been educated. So they're not using their skills, and that holds their income down. And that's going to have long-term effects on their ability to start families and buy houses and so on. So there's a level of frustration there. But what they fundamentally want is a fair opportunity. They want better opportunities to learn on the job, to be trained, to progress, and to learn how to use their skills most effectively. And they want somehow to get back to some wage norms and compensation norms so that their incomes grow as the economy grows. Mm. We had a social contract. As you mentioned, in from the end of World War II till about 1980, wages moved up in tandem with increases in productivity and the cost of living. And then since 1980, we've seen productivity continue to grow, but wages have been flat. And so that gap between the productivity and wages just continue to grow ever since 1980, and that's a big part of why we see this inequality today. So they want to address that. They want to see some fairness. They're ready to do their part, but they're frustrated with the lack of responsiveness of leaders of our key institutions, whether that's government, business, and in some cases labor as well.
We've seen union membership decrease significantly since the 1980s. You have written that it's not your father's unions that young workers yearn for, but neither is it a union-free environment. So what is it?
Well, they're looking for new ways to get good jobs and make sure those jobs stay as good high-paying jobs. And so, yes, they want to work together, but they don't want the big bureaucracy of a union. They don't want union leaders telling them what they need to do. They want to network with their peers. They want to be able to move to where good jobs are and not have to be so tied to a single employer. And so they're looking for new sources of power. And one of the things that I think they value most is information and using information as a source of power. Where are the good jobs? How can we develop apps that tell us who are the good employers, who are the bad employers? Let's really put our emphasis on getting job opportunities with the good employers and putting the ones who don't respect our rights or that pay lousy wages at a disadvantage so that they have an incentive to upgrade their standards. So we're seeing a number of things like that develop. Uber drivers, for example, now have an app where they can input their number of hours they work, the revenue they got, the cost of gas, the cost of insurance and depreciation of their vehicle, and that can calculate for them how much they're actually earning on an hourly basis. And the more information like that and the more Uber drivers start to share that information with each other, the more strength that they can bring to bear in pressuring Uber to give them a fair portion of the revenue from that growing business. So that, I think, is just one example of the creative use of information and other sources of power that the younger generation wants to draw on.
Hmm. So who are the good employers, Professor Calkin?
Well, we've learned over time that there are ways in which you can run a business, manage a business, that is both good for the shareholder, for the owners, as well as for employees and customers. So here in New England last summer, for example, we had this tremendous display of anger on the part of employees and customers at a grocery chain called Market Basket, which is a family-owned business that for years had provided low prices, excellent customer service, good jobs, and had a very loyal workforce of long-standing, long-tenure and was extremely loyal to the CEO. And when the board of that company decided to fire that CEO and replace him with some others who were going to either pull more of the money out of the company for the owners or sell it to some highest bidder, the employees all revolted. And this is a non-union company. And they said, look, this is not right. We've built this company with you. We've served our communities very well. This is what we call a high road company. It's got good competitive strategies, treats its employees well, encourages us and trains us to treat customers well, and we're just not going to accept the loss of that business model or the firing of our CEO. And it took 6 weeks, but they shut basically the business down. The whole community of New England rallied around them. The media had a frenzy about it, saying, you know, look at this, look what they're doing. And in the end, the board relented and sold the company back to the prior CEO, and the business has thrived again as it rebuilt over the last year. Mm-hmm. So there's an example, but you can find examples like that in almost every industry. In groceries, there's often this market basket case, but you could compare Costco, which pays a higher wage, provides better training, gets longer tenure out of its employees, has more productivity, and better customer service compared to Walmart, which pays very low wages, gets subsidized by states like Wisconsin and every other state it's located in for employees who have to be on welfare and food stamps and public assistance. And has extremely high turnover as a result. And so it's how you build the business model and how you invest in employees so that they can be productive so you can afford to pay them that really matters.
We're going to welcome phone calls for our guest. He also has said that we are sitting on a tinderbox, that we start to narrow the differentials by bringing up the bottom, creating a new set of opportunities to expand the middle class and controlling excesses at the top, or we'll have a nation of disillusioned workers, or perhaps a revolt in the making. It would appear to me that we do have a lot of disillusioned workers. We're talking about a number of issues this hour. We wanted to respond to the new overtime rules, which you may have questions about, that the president announced in June. But our guest is involved in so many different issues. He's a professor of management of work and employment research and engineering systems and the co-director of the MIT Sloan Institute for Work and Employment Research at the MIT School of Management. So we're looking at the new overtime rules. We're looking at the American dream for the next generation and how to achieve it. We're looking at the good employers and the bad employers, the social contract. What should it look like? Should it not be your father's union, but it should be some form of labor management agreement that takes a different kind of form? What should the social contract be for 2015? And why is it that we haven't looked at this since we put together the old social contract, which was in place for some 30 years until the 1980s. We welcome your phone calls on these important issues, and here's how you reach us. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. We're also on Facebook, that's the Kathleen Dunn Show, and on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Lines are open for you at this very moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@WPR.org. We are talking about overtime changes. We're looking at labor laws and why there haven't been many changes for so many years. We're looking at how American workers are faring. What are the dreams for young people who are just entering the workforce? And asking for your thoughts on all of this. Jerry in Stockbridge is our first caller. Hi, Jerry.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'd have to differ with the position and of your guest speaker. You know, I spent 40 years in the workforce. I've spent considerable time involved with organized union labor, anywhere from union steward to the primary bargaining delegate, district delegate, and it is, I think, almost naive to try and adopt the position as stated, that this is voluntarily going to come about. Without the big organization, without the financial abilities, without the political muscle that a union represents, you are not going to get anywhere near back, and that we've just spent, I don't know, a decade, 2 decades, 3 decades, losing these rights and abilities. And business tries to beat this down for a reason, and it's not to benefit the worker.
Professor Calkin.
Well, I agree with Jerry that we're going to have reinvent labor unions, and we're going to have to bring them back, and it's going to be a struggle. There's no substitute for strong, independent, innovative labor representation and voice at the workplace. Now, the reality is we can't just go back to collective bargaining as we saw it in the post-war period, because we're in an international global economy. We've got much more competition. So we need some changes in how unions operate. It's not that I believe that unions are obsolete. I believe that they have to approach their task differently. It's going to be a struggle. That's why we need labor law, not only reform, but fundamental updating. New forms of representation, works councils, as they have in Germany and as the UAW, the Auto Workers Union, is trying to implement with Volkswagen in this country. We need labor management partnerships, like you find out at Kaiser Permanente, where labor and management work together to improve health care and to provide industry-leading wages and benefits. But those are goals that bring the best of labor and management together. Now, that's not going to be easy. And unfortunately, you've seen the worst of labor policy in the state of Wisconsin under Governor Walker in the public sector. He, you know, basically destroyed the legacy of collective bargaining that was so strong and so progressive in Wisconsin. So I don't want to be misunderstood. I believe very strongly in the need for unions, but unions also have to find some new approaches to bolstering worker power, because the traditional sources of power are not going to be as effective in the future as they were in the past.
Can you explain a little further, please, Professor, this anti-union sentiment? Because some of what our fathers' unions and mothers' unions gave us, we've all benefited from. Certainly many of the things that they fought for, we've benefited from. So we have a number of candidates, and particularly the governor in Wisconsin, who is in large measure risen to prominence nationally because of his union stance and taking on public unions. And there are a lot of people in this country who are cheering that, who think that that's good, and it's elevated him to national stature and a run for the president. Why is that? What's the anti-union sentiment? Where is it springing from?
Well, I think there's two sources. One is that many people don't understand the history that you so nicely summarized and that Jerry mentioned, that unions were the social and economic engine for progress and for building the middle class. And that's lost because we have a smaller number of families covered by collective bargaining and union membership. And so they're just not aware of where many of the things they take for granted today came from. That's number one. And then number two is this public sector, private sector divide. The decline in unionism is almost a totally, up until Walker, a private sector. It went from 33% of the private sector labor force in the 1950s down to about 7% today. And so then you see the public sector workers sitting out there still at about 35% organized. And it looks like they are being treated better than the private sector. And so there's a little bit of an envy there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're a political target. And you also have all this money that's trying to attack the Democratic Party, and labor unions are one of the biggest contributors to the Democratic Party. The best way to weaken the Democratic Party is to weaken public sector unions. And so you get all of this energy, political energy, put into and resources put into attacking unions. Now, having said that, I look forward to a debate over this issue in the presidential election. I don't believe the American public is ready for an anti-union campaign by one of the presidential candidates, or they won't find it very responsive to their sense of fairness and common sense. And so I think we ought to put this out on the table. We ought to have a real debate about the role of unions, about what they have contributed in the past, and what they could contribute in the future with a forward-looking strategy. Instead of fighting the old labor wars of the 20th century, we ought to be asking, how do we build a labor movement and worker organizations that fit the 21st century economy and workforce? Mm-hmm. That debate, I think, would be a healthy one, and I suspect the American public, with a strong, positive view of where unions and worker organizations could go in the future, would be very responsive.
Mm-hmm. And address the issue that you did in your class. How do we help the next generation achieve their American dream? We don't want them to have struggle.
No, if we do nothing, if we let the status quo dominate in the future, we're destined to leave our children and grandchildren with a legacy that their standard of living is going to be lower than ours. I don't think any of us as parents or as citizens want to have that as our legacy. So we've got to get on with the task of getting wages moving in the right direction again and giving workers the opportunity to use their talents and skills to build a strong middle class and to be able to provide for their families the way basically our baby boom generation was able to do.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jerry, very much for your call. We go to others now at 800-486-8655. And our guest this hour is Professor Thomas Calkin. He's a professor of management, engineering systems, co-director of the Institute for Work and Employment Research at MIT. We talked now to Malunda in Green Bay. Hi, Malunda.
Good afternoon. Great program. Great timing on this topic. My question to your guest was, when did executive compensation skyrocket, and how did the middle class or the middle workers stand back, or how did they remain so behind when it came to pay increases or compensation? And that's all I have on my question. I'll take it off the air.
Thanks, Melinda. Thanks for the call.
Well, thank you, Melinda. You know, the 1980s were really a watershed decade. That's when a lot of this sense of fairness began to unravel, and the old social contract broke down. And in the 1980s, if those of us who have been around for long enough to remember, you had all these leveraged buyouts, and you had hostile takeovers, and you had new financial instruments developing where the norm was, we have to somehow tie executive compensation more closely with shareholder interests. And so you got all of these bonuses and stock options being built into executive compensation contracts, and that's when compensation started to skyrocket. We went from a pay ratio of executive top executives to average workers of about 30 to 1 in the 1960s and 70s. Now, to depending on how you measure it, between 250
Whoa.
And 300.
Oh my gosh!
And I don't think that's sustainable. If you all the surveys that have been done, if you ask American workers or the American public, what do you think is a fair differential? They'll have some much much lower number, and they don't most people don't even understand that it skyrocketed that much. They know it's high. But when they're shown the actual numbers, they're astounded. And so I think even among some top executives now and business leaders, you're seeing a recognition that this is not sustainable. Something needs to be done, but there's no consensus yet over what needs to be done.
And it's my understanding that those who have all of that money, that 250 or 300 to 1, aren't giving it back so that it can help spark the economy. People are essentially holding on to money. What are they doing with it?
Well, there's been way too much of hoarding cash and not reinvesting in businesses. So we've seen stock buybacks by companies where they purchase some of their stock from shareholders back, so that it further inflates the price. And you see executives putting a lot more money into real estate, with multiple homes and increasing the price of very high cost luxury homes. You see a lot more money flowing overseas to other uses, and so we have not reinvested in the American economy as much as we need to foster future growth. We're beginning to see a little bit more higher rates of investment now, but nothing close to what we need to sustain this economy and to get us back to a pattern of growth that allows us to share the benefits of growth widely.
Robert sends this email. I'd like to mention that if the minimum wage is adjusted for inflation from its maximum buying power in 1968, it would be around $11.25 by 2016, assuming about 2% inflation this year. That figure would represent a wage with historical precedent in real purchasing power versus the $15 figure seemingly pulled out of thin air.
Well, Robert has done his homework, and I applaud that. I think his numbers sound exactly right to me. The $15 an hour has a nice ring, and it came out of largely a campaign in Seattle where labor leaders, business leaders, and the city officials negotiated a $15 an hour minimum down the road in stages. $15 an hour is not viable right now. Maybe in 5 years, or moved in five in small increments up to that level down the road, that's a reasonable number. But right now, moving to $10 to $11 an hour would probably, again, maybe done in increments, not all at once, but in a couple of years' time, over a couple of years' time frame, would allow business to adjust to it. Would not have, by most estimates, not a significant effect on employment. That is, it wouldn't lead to high levels of unemployment. And you would increase purchasing power and help not only those at the bottom, but it would help the overall economy.
We're going to talk about a case for optimism. Our guest says there is one, and we'll look more at what he's described as a range of innovations that are happening at local levels. So we'll talk more about those. This hour, we're looking at a number of issues. President Obama's announcement of new overtime rules, which took place in June. They may go into place unless there are a lot of legal challenges, and the public comment period goes on for a long period of time in January. It will affect 5 million workers. But why is it that we haven't seen a new social contract, or we haven't seen any changes in labor law for a long, long time in this country? What needs to happen? What needs to happen for our young people to be able to realize that their dreams for a future can happen? How do we make their dreams a reality? And what is it they want from work? What do you want from work? Do you feel that you're being paid fairly? What do you think about what you're making compared with what CEOs are making? Is the gap too large? Do you think that we are indeed sitting on a tinderbox here? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. We go to Sean in Burlington next. Hello, Sean.
Hi.
Hi.
Obviously, with our gridlock Congress, we're not going to overturn Taft-Hartley, but I wonder what the guest thinks about challenging it on constitutional grounds. it seems to me unconstitutional due to the right of free association. And the right to work thing is always sold on the backs of, well, people shouldn't have to be forced to join a union. Meanwhile, it seems to be okay for a union to be forced to represent and defend people in workplace actions that refuse to join the union. And that just doesn't seem, it's not fair. And it strikes me as possibly unconstitutional.
Well, Sean, I worry about the Supreme Court dealing with labor issues today. They, in fact, are going in the other direction. They're looking for opportunities, at least the conservative justices on the Supreme Court are looking for opportunities to roll back worker rights. You're more likely to see the Supreme Court take up a case soon that further strengthens right to work and, in fact, could extend it to all public employees. That case, most experts expect it to come before the Supreme Court soon because they've asked for that kind of case. And so I worry about what the Supreme Court, in its current configuration, would do with labor law today. I think they would roll it back rather than find Taft-Hartley unconstitutional. Down the road, I think we can hope that we get stronger support for worker rights from both Congress and the judiciary. But right now, unfortunately, they're hostile. And that's why we have to look in the short run for innovations at the local level and then try to get Congress and the president and our national leaders to come around to their senses.
Thank you, Sean. Phil in Crystal Lake. Hi.
Hi. I just have a question. I think part of the problem, a big part, is that over the last 35 years, wages have dropped and taxes have dropped. They've gone down, and that takes money out of the economy and has shrunk the economy so that when we go to get a job, there are just fewer jobs because the economy doesn't have the money it needs to grow. Based on productivity growth or any other reason, it's just kind of is flat for the lower-end workers.
Well, Phil, I think there's a lot of truth to what you're saying. You know, we in the 1960s had a 70, in fact, before that, a larger tax rate for income taxes at the top of our wage and income distribution. We're now down to in the mid-30s for the top rate for income tax. And there are many ways in which people at the top find that they can protect their incomes through different kinds of investments to lower the effective tax rate. And that really does starve our state and our national economy. The best way we could get our economy growing, if we could get the tax revenue flowing again, would be to invest in infrastructure, not only roads and bridges and highways and airports and so on, but also the modern infrastructure of the information economy with broadband and catching up with our competitors around the world in those areas, because that has been shown by economists, conservative and liberal, to have the highest rate of return as an investment, and it builds long-term competitiveness. The analogy would be President Eisenhower supporting the interstate highway system development in the 1950s. That did more to boost the American economy and to drive productivity improvements than probably any other public investment since the end of World War II. We need to do the same thing for infrastructure. And then the second thing is, if we reinvested in education, we would again get high rates of return in terms of meeting employer needs for skilled workers and giving workers the human capital needed to get ahead in our society. But we're starving our elementary schools, we're starving our high schools, and now in Wisconsin you're starving the university system. That's going in the wrong direction.
Thanks for the call, Phil. If you are concerned about the Supreme Court, as you've indicated, and concerned about Congress, please tell us more about what you have said is the good news, the case for optimism, which is coming from innovations that are happening at local levels that could sow the seeds that grow into national solutions. What are those innovations at the local levels?
Well, we're seeing tremendous innovation both in the public sector and in the private sector. At the state level, you're seeing some states, California, New Jersey, Illinois, and now an increasing number of others, move forward to provide paid sick leave. Massachusetts just did that in November of last year. For parents who need to take time off to take care of their children or themselves, to provide more family leave, we're seeing the minimum wage addressed at state levels and in some cases city levels, where there's living wage ordinances in San Francisco and in other cities, in Milwaukee. And so the local politicians are beginning to get the message that they need to take action to boost the living standards and provide fair compensation for people in their jurisdictions because of the gridlock in Washington. In the private sector, you're seeing more companies like I mentioned Market Basket or Southwest Airlines or Costco or Kaiser Permanente in the healthcare field and others that are leading the way in investing in their employees, in driving productivity and customer service up so that they can afford to pay good wages and provide long-term careers. And we're seeing startups around the country begin with a social mission as well as a financial goal of saying, we want to build a business that addresses important issues, that motivates young people to join us, to bring all their technical prowess and put it to work for important causes and build businesses that provide both good returns to us as founders and owners, as well as good jobs and address big problems. So I think that's my basis for optimism. We in the past, in the early part of this century, in states like Wisconsin, Wisconsin pioneered much of the legislation that ended up as part of the National New Deal under President Roosevelt. Wisconsin invented unemployment insurance. Wisconsin academics at the university invented Social Security. Wisconsin was the first state to have a comprehensive workers' compensation system. It was among the first, not the first, but among the first to pass a minimum wage act. And when Roosevelt got elected, a lot of the people who had the practical experience of how these policies worked went to Washington and helped to shape the New Deal legislation. So I think we're in a similar period, and so that's what gives me some optimism. What we need is the political movement now to take these local innovations to the national level.
Let's go to Mike in Franklin next. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just like to say what we need to do is support politicians that stand up for increases in the minimum wage, for living wages for all American workers. And we don't need politicians like Scott Walker who go to their donors and tell them that they're going to divide and conquer the state. He proceeds to do it, and then people vote him back into office. We actually need politicians when they say that, and then we need voters. Like me, I'm a retired union man. I appreciate what the union did for me, but we need voters to support the right candidate. Thank you.
Thank you for the call, Mike.
Well, my view on this is that we need a very positive, forward-looking agenda. That's what will energize young people. That's what will energize voters to say there's a vision here for how the economy should work and how it should be fair. And I think if we just take this issue of fairness and say we need a strategy for fair wages, a fair day's work for a fair day's pay, it goes way back to, passages in the Bible and everywhere else in between. And I think with a positive view of the future, the electorate will respond. A negative fight, you know, to hold workers down, or a negative fight against just the Scott Walkers of the world is not enough. We've got to give people some sense of hope, a sense of vision, sense that we can get things done, and that if we all work together and we use the good common sense that people in Wisconsin are so well known for, then I think we can get there.
And we go to Laura in Milwaukee. Hello.
Hello. My father, who is still alive and lives on the south side of Milwaukee now, was involved in the coal strike. And they were shot at. They were shot at by the National Guard for going out on strike. That's what being in a union used to mean. Going out on strike could get you killed. In Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And people forgot that.
People have forgotten a lot about the union history in this country. We've touched on that, Professor.
Well, I think that's unfortunate, but it's true. Labor history is hardly taught in universities anymore. Those who take it because they're already interested. Here, let me bring it closer to home. In our schools of business that I teach in and others across the country, we don't do enough to teach about the role of the history of labor and the history of unions and the vision about how we can create a high road economy that works for everyone. That's why I taught the online course. That's why I'm working very hard to spread courses like this across business school curricula. We've got to educate the next generation in ways that tell them there are choices, there are alternatives, and there are ways to make this economy work for everyone. And yes, part of this online course was a good history of the New Deal and of the role of collective bargaining up through the 20th century. And so an appreciation of history, not because we necessarily just go back to the past. It wasn't so great, as Laura indicated. We don't want to go back to a bloody labor history. But we want to have respect for workers. We want to have rights for workers to have a voice. We want to give them some control over their future. And we want business and labor to work together for the common good.
I think it would be really interesting if we can work with you to gather three of the students who were in your class to talk about their American dreams. It would be a very interesting discussion because it's their future, right?
It's their future, and that's what led me to take to teach this course. I have been working on a book, and I now will have a book out by the beginning of next year.
Great.
Brings their voice into this process. But my colleagues all said when I first drafted it, you've got to get their voice in it. It's not enough for you to say again what you think. Mm-hmm. Listen to them. And so that's what led me to the course. And now
I'm delighted we could listen to you. And thank you so much. Please join us again.
I'd love to do so. Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Professor Thomas Calkin, he's a professor of management, work and employment research, engineering systems, co-director of the MIT Sloan Institute for Work and Employment Research. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers.